Karen gave you a little input at breakfast this morning. The United Nations has declared 1979 as the year of the child, and the National Council of Churches has picked up on that and said, let's have the year of the child in the churches. How much this will happen, I think, depends on you people that are pastors and lay people in congregations. They called a meeting of their member denominations, and everybody was to send a representative. I was the only Lutheran in the crowd, so I don't know whether the Lutheran Church is not going to advocate for children or whether they just didn't have staff that was available. That was true of the American Lutheran Church, which is why I went. I am not staff for the ALC, but I was very glad to go, and it was an interesting meeting to attend. When I came home, I drew together a group of suggestions that I think congregations can use in celebrating the Year of the Child. And I guess I'm going to continue the role of people who have sat in this chair the last few days and tell you what's wrong with the world, and then I'm going to tell you how to make it right, which I'm not sure everybody else did. I'm going to spend more time on that. But I really feel...
Before you start on that, give us a little bit about what was the genesis of this in the UN. Was there someone in the assembly?
I really don't know that answer, Fred. All I know is that the UN every 3 or 4 years declares a year of, and it was International Women's Year last year, and I've forgotten what the one was before that, but they do occasionally have a thrust, and next year it's going to be children, and all I can say is thank God somebody's finally noticing the children. My feelings as I listen to Joe sit here and lecture is that a lot of this problem that he talks about could have been prevented if children had really been raised in homes where they learned love and forgiveness and did not have to be part of a pecking order where they felt the bottom, because the minute you're on the bottom end of a pecking order or even halfway down, you've got to find somebody below you to peck on. This is just apparently the way animals are made. You can see it in a chicken yard, you can watch it at your bird feeder. You can see it if you have more than one cat or dog in your house. This is the way people are. And if we are oppressed as children and get the feeling that power is the thing to have because that's what daddy or mommy has, we tend to find somebody that we can take advantage of, whether it's, a psychology professor of mine told about watching children in his backyard. The mother had scolded the children, and the oldest child went out, and pretty soon he was landing on the next youngest one, who then landed on the next youngest one. It worked its way down to the two-year-old, who went over and kicked the dog. See, that's all that was left. And when men grow up, they tend to, you know, do this as nations, that they are where they have the power. To have power, all of us want power, and we need to have power over ourselves, and when we get that self-control and feel that we are in power and not being manipulated, then we don't have the need to manipulate others. Anyway, that's just a little prelude. I want to quickly go on to these suggestions. I hope that most of you are here because you are interested in advocating for children. I feel like children are the congregation of the future, and it behooves us to bring them up in the way that we would like that to go in the future, because children are always learning. They are learning constantly, whether we are actually setting out to teach them or not. They are learning by default if we don't set out to teach them. Children are modeling after the adults that they see. And whatever you want them to learn, that's what you better be. You can't fake it. They watch this. And it's rather curious that children very often learn just the opposite of what we think we are teaching them. And it would behoove us to be more observant of children and to listen to children more carefully to get some clues as to what they actually are learning and what they actually are becoming. So I'd like to suggest some ways that we advocate for children in our churches. If we want to be terribly selfish about it, we can even say, when I am an elderly person, I am going to have to live in the world that the children of today are creating as middle-aged people. And therefore, I want to be very sure that they are going to be capable of creating the kind of world that I want to live in when I'm elderly, which is a world without repression and with love and forgiveness. And if the person who thinks we need a Bible verse to start with is here, I want to say that I think all of what I'm going to say is based on Bible study, and if we take time to do the Bible study, we're not going to get to the suggestions. So I would assume that you all have the scriptural concepts in heart from which my suggestions are being drawn. I would like to suggest then, first of all, that each one of you go home and find some other people in your congregation with the help of your pastor who are interested in advocating for children, and say, this is a good time to begin because there's going to be publicity on this. The UN has declared this the year of the child. The Council of Churches is behind this. The Lutheran Church has officially said, okay, let's join in with this, even though they probably will not send you tons of packets and things. It is not going to be a major thrust in the ALC, and I would assume, since no one went to that meeting, that it probably won't be in the other synods, but I don't know for sure about those. They maybe just didn't have someone who could come. So the number one suggestion is to form a group of people who would like to work on child advocacy, whether you call it the Child Advocacy Committee or you just don't give it a label. And that committee can take one of three thrusts, or you can, if you have enough people that are interested, you can go into three areas. I think it would probably be good to start with one, and then when that one gets pretty solidly going, take up another one, unless you have quite a group of people that you could say, well, you take one, and you take one, and you take one. But there are three directions that the Chapel of Churches has suggested that we look to advocate for children. One is congregational, obviously, and the second one is community, so that the congregation reaches farther than its own four walls. And the third one is even farther than that we look at children globally. So concerns need to fall into those three areas: congregational, community, and global. And I think that once you have a group of children, a group of people, then you need to become knowledgeable. And I'm going to suggest two ways that you do that. One is to get together a group of children in your congregation and draw up a list of questions that you would ask them to answer. Now, this is a very difficult thing for adults to do, because we tend to know what the answers are when we talk to children, and so we don't really listen to what they are telling us, because we already know the answer and we want them to tell us the right answer. But I would suggest that you really try to listen to these children and ask them questions to find out how they feel about their lives. How do they feel about their life in their lives in their homes? How do they feel about what's happening to them in school, in the community, and especially what is happening to them in the church? One of the representatives at the meeting from Canada told about a meeting with children that he scheduled like this, and he said they were really floored at the things the children told them. The one that stuck with me the most was that the children resented something that the congregation had structured to meet children's needs, thinking this is what children want. They resented being dismissed halfway through the service and sent into another room, as though they weren't really part of the worshiping congregation. So I think it's important for us to think of our congregation as the baptized membership and not just the confirmed membership. And if you think about the programming in your congregation, what percent of it is actually for children? If you take away the educational part, think of the worship part of church. How much of it do children really comprehend? How much of it are they able to participate with, understanding what they're doing? I don't know how many of you have the Lord's Supper, including the children. I often wonder how the liturgy includes children. When I was a child, I enjoyed the liturgy, but that was because I liked to harmonize. So once I was in third grade and had learned about harmony, I enjoyed that. And I enjoyed the stained glass windows. But I found with my own children, there weren't any stained glass windows, and they didn't care about the liturgy as much as I did. And it became a difficult time for them, because they weren't comprehending. The vocabulary and the sentence structure was over their heads, and they did not feel included in the worship. The other thing that I'd like to suggest that you do to become knowledgeable is to read a book called All Our Children. All Our Children is the base book that the National Council of Churches is going to ask us to read. You can get it at the library, or if you have a group of people wanting to order it, you may buy it at great savings from the Institutional Marketing Department. And I'll go slow if you want to write this down. Of Harcourt, Brace, and Jovanovich. They're the publishers. Institutional Marketing Department, Harcourt, Brace, Jovanovich. And their address is 757 3rd Avenue, New York, 10017. The name of the book is All Our Children by Kenneth Keniston and the Carnegie Council on Children. The Carnegie Foundation funded a council to do a study of what is needed by children in our culture. And their conclusion was that we need broad, sweeping social changes, that the little stopgap things that we tend to do aren't really accomplishing what children need to have done for them. And the way to really advocate for children is to advocate for family life in our society. We are really more economically motivated, and in the money market, families tend to go down the tube. So what you need to do is to read the first three chapters of this book, and then individual committees or groups that would want to go further in actually carrying out some of the suggestions in the book would want to go into the other chapters. They're more technical. But I think everybody who's going to work at child advocacy should read the first three chapters just to get a beat on what is really happening to children in our culture today. If you mail for these books, include your church's tax exemption number, and then you'll get them even cheaper. And then to help you study that book, there has been written a children's political checklist, which provides you with a study guide so that you can get into it in better depth. And you can order that from the Coalition for Children and Youth, 1815 15th Street Northwest, Washington, D.C. 1815 15th Street Northwest. And the zip is 2005. For a group that would like to consider global concerns in advocating for children, I think that you can start from two sources. One is your own denominational headquarters, which can give you help through Lutheran World Federation. I'll give you an address for the ALC, and if you don't know your own denomination, I'm sure that the ALC would be glad to send materials to anyone who asked. You would write to the DLMC, which is the Division for Life and Mission in the Church. DLMC, care of the American Lutheran Church. And that's 422 South 5th Street, Minneapolis, 55415.
Do that last part again.
422 South 5th Street, 55415. And you can ask them for any current materials they have on world hunger and the Lutheran World Federation's things for children. They have for a long time been sending what they call kitty kits, which is a nice thing for children to make up to send to other children around the world. Another place you can get information for beginning to do something on a global level is from the U.S. Committee for UNICEF, the Field Services Department, 331 East 38th Street, New York, 10016. One of the people that works for that committee did speak to our meeting and told us that some of the things that were happening in his congregation, which is an LCA congregation in Manhattan. You would want to ask them for the pamphlet, How Can I Help? UNICEF's Children. And then any other current literature that they may have devised since we heard him speak. They also have available slides and film strips on the rights of children with teacher's guides and cassette tapes that you could have for a sort of kickoff meeting if you wanted to. Then I would like to suggest that for a global level that you would start a letter writing group. I heard on the radio the other day that as few as 18 letters can change a congressman's mind about how he's going to vote. That is not very many. And I'm sure that if all of us went home and found 17 other people in our congregation, since we're from all over the United States, if we each wrote a letter to somebody about some concern for children, then it would make a tremendous impact, and it would probably be enough just starting with the people in this room to really start some changes. I think it's important for us to keep in touch with what kinds of lobbying or what kinds of lobbying we could be doing for children's laws in our country, and I think you can keep in touch with information on that through Walter Mondale's office if you can't through your own legislatures, and check on into with the League of Women Voters to see what's happening in your own state. These things I can't tell you because they change so quickly. The PTA is another place where you can get information on children's television. That was their thrust last year, to try to get rid of violence on children's television. I think all of us can write letters to people who are sponsoring children's programs that we feel have the kinds of values we would like children to learn, and thank them for that and tell them that we're behind them. We can also write letters to the sponsors of shows that are full of violence and hatred, and tell those people that we disapprove of that. That will count for a great deal if you just write a paragraph and put a 15-cent stamp on it. You can write to your station and tell them that you would rather that they not show those kinds of, of shows, and that counts too. You should know what you're talking about, though, when you write. It would be a neat thing, a helpful thing, if your group would write up some core content and mimeograph this and circulate it in your congregation and say to people, would you, in your own words, write a letter about this to these sponsors? I wrote a letter to Sears Roebuck not long ago. I found heard over the radio that they had just given up sponsoring a couple programs that had violence. And I wrote to them and thanked them for that. And I got this great big bunch of stuff back telling them that they really appreciated hearing from me. And that really means a lot to those people, because they are out to make money. And the only way they're going to know whether their programs are making money and whether they're worth their advertising dollar or not is whether it increases sales and whether they hear from the people that are buying things. So I wrote to them and said, I'm one of your customers, and I really don't like it when programs come on the TV that teach children violence, and I'm very appreciative that you are dropping your sponsorship. Just a few sentences is all you need to talk about. I think it's important also to write to the manufacturers of children's cereals. Many things are being put on the market now that are labeled cereal that are actually up to as much as 80% sugar. My daughter recently read some research on what sugar does to the body, and it's not only that it decays children's teeth, it also has adverse effects on the way our bodies function. And she read some research that says that sugar does just about the same things to our bodies that alcohol does. Now, I don't know if any of you would like to send your children off to school in the morning with a martini for breakfast. Maybe Joe Brandt would, but he doesn't have any children, so. You know, that I think most parents would feel like that is not a nutritious breakfast, but we will do the same thing with these cold cereals without realizing that that's probably having the same type of toxic effect on the system. Therefore, it would behoove us to write to these companies and say, can't you please put something on the market that is sugarless and that is whole grain, because I want my child to have the best nutrition possible. The reason people are buying these things is because they don't realize, mothers don't realize that they're giving their children something that isn't good for them. The children like this. I wrote a letter to the dietitian in our school district not long ago and said that I did not appreciate the sugary snacks that were being sent into the daycare center, and that I wished that they would send whole grains and natural fruits, natural sugars contained in apples and oranges and that sort of thing. And the nutritionist phoned me, and she talked for about an hour and a half on the telephone explaining to me that she was gradually trying to wean the children away from sugar, and she was making some inroads. And one of the things she told me was that when the cooks gave the children a choice of something like Alphabits, which is, I don't know what percent sugar, but just at least half sugar, and something like we had for breakfast this morning, just plain whole grains, that most of the children would choose the Alphabet. Well, you see, I feel like this is a cop-out, because it's the cook who can manipulate the environment and still give the children a choice within that environment. And when she presents them with two choices, one of which is not valid, she is saying to the child, in effect, you can also choose things that aren't good for you. And I don't think that's helpful to children as adults. We have trained children to like sugar. And the reason there are more and more sugary things on the market is because when the companies do taste tests, and I've been involved in these taste tests in Minneapolis, where General Mills and Pillsbury have their offices, they give you four kinds of things to taste. Well, we have been, through our lifetime, taught to really prefer the sweeter things. So people taste these four things, and they say, well, I like this one best. Well, that's probably, if that one is the competitor's and it has more sugar in it, then the company giving the taste test will say, well, we'll add more sugar to our product, and then we'll sell more because this is what people prefer. And so over the past decade, products have been given more and more sugar. We train our children to like sugar when we say to them, if you clean your plate, you can have a dessert. Or, you know, if you get your room cleaned, we'll go out to the Dairy Queen, or this sort of thing. We have been trained and we continue to train our children to think of the sweet things as the priority foods. And actually, when we look at that logically, that is not what we really believe. Wouldn't you rather your child have a piece of lettuce than a teaspoon of sugar for a meal, if you had a choice? And yet this is what I mean when I say children are learning by default, whether they're learning what we set out to teach them or not. But since there are so many people who don't realize this and who aren't reading and aren't concerned about nutrition and just don't understand these things, I think it behooves us to pressure the source of these foods by letter writing. Let's get into community concerns then. One of the things that all our children recommends is that family life could be improved and people would have more time to work with their children if work schedules could be adjusted to advocate for family life rather than for money making. And some of it really does improve money making at the same time. So it would be a good thing for a child advocacy committee in a congregation to gather together all the employers in the congregation, and perhaps you could go from your congregation then to the community and ask of those people that they do things in their companies in scheduling to advocate for families. One of the things that can be done is to use flex time. I talked to a mother not long ago in one of our daycare centers who works on flex time. All that means is that you can come to work anytime between 7 and 9 and you can leave anytime between 3 and 5. This would mean that if both parents had to work, mother could go early and father could go and come home early so that father could get the children off to school and mother would be there when they came back from school, which would mean that somebody would be there at home with the children at all times and they wouldn't have to be on their own or in institutional care, which is just impossible to have quite as good as a good home. So flex time would be one thing. Shared jobs would be another way to go. There are probably all sorts of creative scheduling times that could come up. I talked to someone at a hamburger stand in my community a couple years ago. She was just bubbling and I said, you really seem to like your work. And I was sort of grateful that somebody liked selling hamburgers in a hamburger shop because that wouldn't appeal to me, and I was glad that someone else liked that. She said, oh, this is just a wonderful job. She said, we don't have to be here until 10 o'clock because, you know, this is a lunch and dinner operation. They don't serve breakfast. And she said, I can get my children off to work and get my housework done, and I'm getting my housework done quicker because I have some place to go when I get it finished. And she said, then we come in here at 10 o'clock, and by 2:30, the high school kids are here to take over our work, and we can go home and be there when the elementary kids come home from school. So she thought this was all worked out, and I thought, this is really a super way for these people to hire. They are hiring mothers during school hours only. And then they are hiring students to replace the mothers at the times when students need to have jobs. Now, I think there are probably any number of jobs in our culture that could be shared by mothers and students, because mothers don't want to work when children are out of school, but that's when students want to work. So, you know, that would be another neat way to go. Another way is to have a couple share a job, or have two housewives share a job so that one of them can stay home with somebody that's sick. That has been tried successfully. I think another thing that employers could do would be to provide daycare on the premises. I think a mother would feel a lot better if she could take the child and you know, leave it in another room where she's working, drop in to see it on her coffee break. Maybe they could have their breaks at the same time, have lunch with her child. I think one of the things that people worry about with daycare and flex time and so on is the old-fashioned notion that mothers should not be working. And I call that old-fashioned because I guess I really feel like one parent or the other should be at home with small children. But having worked in daycare now for a few years, I begin to realize that there are many, many people for whom this is simply not an alternative. And rather than punishing the children by saying, well, those parents ought to take care of their children and leaving it at that, the church would be a really logical organization to jump in and say, these children need to be cared for. And since the parents aren't able to do it, let us jump in and be sure that the care these children are getting is the highest quality care that is possible. I think we need to to be forgiving in mistakes that people have made so that their lives have fallen apart and they are single parents, and not punish the next generation because of mistakes that parents have made. All right, another thing that we could do then is to assess the needs for children's services in your community. This is a difficult thing to do, because when we ask questions of people, we tend to have the answers in mind. And the way we ask questions, sometimes people color their answers. Someone here yesterday was saying that she does Gallup polls. Is that person in the room? That it's difficult to ask the question that will get the real answer rather than the answer that person thinks you're asking for, or the answer that you think you want to get. So I'd like to suggest that if you have a college or university in your community, that you would phone there and get someone in their sociology or anthropology department who is trained to build questionnaires to do this for you. A book that can be used in helping to do that is called Planning and Assessment in Community Education, and that's by Brubeck and Decker. It's published by Midland Pendle in 1977. So you could use that book if you had some professional person that could help build a questionnaire. If you don't have that resource, another suggestion would be that you would talk to the Council of Churches in the community or the Ministerial Association. Talk to recreation departments, community colleges, talk to the police chief and see at what age groups there's a crime problem. Talk to the health department. Sometimes the tax pressure now is going to mean that there is a cut in services, and perhaps this would be a way that your congregation could pick up advocating for children. Maybe something like the early assessment of children's hearing and sight problems could be done by a church. You maybe have nurses and doctors that could volunteer a morning to take care of that. Another way to go is to the city or county local planning office and look at the demographic data. If you have a large concentration of apartment houses somewhere, you can just bet your boots that there are going to be a lot of single parents there who need help. And this is a wonderful place for the church to begin a ministry. Another place to go is existing agencies like United Way or the Daycare Association, or just even ask local daycare or nursery schools. If they have long waiting lists, you know that more services are needed. If they're having trouble filling their slots, then you know that's covered. That's not a way to go. Then from that assessment, plan to use the rooms that are sitting idle in your building through the morning. And when you do that, there are two things that I have found through experience are really important to keep in mind. One is that if you're going to set up a program like this, you should consider it a ministry of your congregation and consider it as part of your evangelism program. If it's simply there as a service to the community, statistics have shown that it tends to die out very quickly. But if it is a way to minister to people's needs, it will flourish, and surely the Lord will bless it. The other thing that you need to take into consideration is that you have to plan for people who are going to be against it and have some kind of a contingency plan for how you're going to meet their needs to keep this beautiful building that they have fought and died for and that their father has put the latch on the door and that sort of thing. There are always people who feel like this is our building and we paid for it and we are not going to see these children tearing it apart, because things are going to get damaged. As soon as you begin ministering to children who have not had enough love and affection in their lives, you are going to have children who have learned that the only way to get their gut level needs for belongingness, for attention, needs that all of us have attended to, is to do something bizarre. And believe me, people, I have worked with children as little as 3 years old who have already learned that the only way to be looked at is to do something that the adult considers naughty. They believe this, and if you're going to start working with those kinds of people, then you have to plan for damage. It is very hard to reach out to that kind of person and say, hey, look, you don't have to break something for me to look at you. I'm going to love you anyway. But isn't this a way to get through that love comes from above, and through me, Christ's love reaches out to whoever needs it? I think that's what it's all about. I guess I personally don't have much time for the attitude that says, this building is too lovely, this is the house of the Lord, and therefore we're not going to let these children damage it. They should not be allowed to damage it, but they should be helped to see another person's point of view. This belongs to a group of people. It is not yours to damage. Children can be taught this.
Maybe they ought to study what dedication of a building means.
Right. But rather than, what I'm saying, Fred, is rather than close the program down, we need to help these children to realize, because this is something they need to learn. You don't have to do these things to be noticed, because they really believe this unconsciously.
But I mean the people who might be opposed to it.
I see. What it was dedicated for, yes. What its real purpose is.
Because they committed themselves to something.
That's right. That's a good thought. I was very sad, and a couple years ago I visited a friend of mine who lives in a large city in our country. She belonged to the big downtown Lutheran church, and this church was ministering to the people in the community with a Head Start program. When she told me the background of some of those babies that she was taking care of, I just had to cry, because there's just no way that those children can grow up whole unless they have vast amounts of help, because the people who are raising them simply don't have the resources to give them what their needs are. So this church was doing this, but they had voted to disband and to not offer their building anymore to the Head Start program. It was a perfect place for Head Start. They not only had rows of little empty rooms for classrooms, but they had a big kitchen that could cook the meals. They had a lovely big gymnasium for days like this. They really had a very good setup. It was centrally located. It was easy to get the children to, and it was working just beautifully. They did not find a comparable place to have Head Start when they were forced to leave this building. The reason they had to leave was that the congregation found it very inconvenient to have these people there. If they wanted to have an ALC luncheon once in a while, ALCW luncheon, they had to wait until the kitchen was cleaned up before they could move in. And the halls, of course, had to be, the floors had to be polished more often, and sometimes they came in and found finger paint or toothpaste smeared on the lavatories, and they found that these things apparently were more important to them than ministering to these children. And as I left, my friend, I had to leave on a Sunday morning because I had to be back to work on Monday, and it was an 8-hour drive. As I got into my car and they got into their car to go to church, I turned on the radio, and pretty soon I got their church's program, so I felt like in effect attending church with them. And this was a few years back when our denomination had a big United Mission appeal, and this money was going to be given to all sorts of wonderful seed programs that were going to do wonderful ministries all over the country and all over the world. And this minister was saying how thrilled he was because this congregation had oversubscribed. They had given all these monies, and he was describing some of the wonderful things this money was going to do, and that it was going to feed these starving little children in Bangladesh and so on and so on. And I thought, but what about those dirty little Indians in your backyard that you are throwing out of your building? You know, maybe it's easier for us to give of our affluence into the offering plate and read about what the money is doing than to actually get our hands dirty or our kitchen dirty by working with children that are right there under our noses. And I don't mean to downgrade the giving of money, because those things are needed too. At any rate, I can just guarantee you that there is likely to be somebody who's going to say, this is not a good thing because look at this broken switch plate, or this kid put paintbrushes down the sink. These are things that I got at my school in a church one time. So let me suggest then some of the possibilities that a congregation might take up to advocate for children with your rooms that are sitting empty over long periods of time. I think buildings are too expensive nowadays for us to even think about leaving them empty through the week. One of the things that we do have to consider is that we just can't have the same kinds of programs that were there for us when we were youth, because times have changed and we need to listen to what children feel their needs really are. And if I can, I will give you a model that if you're really interested in this, you could write to and get some information as to how they were successful. One of the things that I might suggest would be a youth drop-in center. In my town, Bloomington, Minnesota, there is a drop-in center for youth that is sponsored by the Bloomington Ministerium, or Council of, what do they call it? I think they call it the Ministerial Association. It's called Side by Side, and its address is Creekside Center, 9800 Penn Avenue South, Bloomington, 55431. this center hires a couple seminarians. And I don't know how these boys get away with it, but they hang around inside the high schools. And they make friends with the do-nothing kids. And then they try to help these children to find goals in life, through Christ. Now that they get started by being allowed to be in the high schools themselves. And they are, one of our high schools is on modular scheduling, so those kinds of kids tend to be sitting around in the union instead of, you know, in the pot shop or in the swimming pool or woodworking or in the resource center doing their homework. That has been a very successful program. They also have an office at the Creekside Center. Another thing that one could do would be to begin a nursery school or a daycare center for preschoolers. And if you find that this is a need in your community, I'd like to suggest that you write to the American Lutheran Church, Department of Life, DLMC, Department of Life and Mission, and ask them to send you a fantastic booklet that Geneva Schenck wrote. Her name is spelled S-H-E-N-K. It's called To Begin With, and it will have everything in it that you need to know to get started with any kind of an early childhood program in your congregation. I would like to see an early childhood program that would ask parents to commit an evening a week or an afternoon. I particularly like an evening because I think fathers should be included. For some reason or other, parenting programs attract mothers, and fathers seem to feel that they already know all that or they don't have time for that, and I really feel they probably need to learn more parenting skills just as badly as we do. So it ought to be available for fathers. But anyway, Geneva's booklet To Begin With will give you all kinds of suggestions on how to begin and what questions to ask and what equipment to get. You will probably not be aware of it because it doesn't always rear its ugly head, but almost every community needs to meet the needs of abused children. There is an excellent American Lutheran Church nursery school which is currently meeting the needs of abused children and their parents. If you want to meet children's needs, you meet their parents' needs, and then the children's needs often are taken care of. Jean Wingy, who used to live at Holden Village, is currently doing a great deal to work with a nursery school in a place called Christus House, and you can write to her for information if you'd like to get something like this started. And I believe the address is 28th Avenue, 28th Street at 18th Avenue in Minneapolis. Or you could call your county child protection agency and get their help in setting up a nursery school for abused children. I have a lot of information here on how you could get that started, or Jean will tell you if you write to her. Another place to start would be to start a chapter of Parents Anonymous, which is a group like Alcoholics Anonymous, but it works with people who are child abusers. A lot of people are potential child abusers, and they don't want to be, and they really want help, but they are struggling with their own feelings, and they have to have some place to take them out, and the child is the most logical place, the most vulnerable spot. Parents Anonymous have a toll-free phone that you could phone. It's 800-421-0353, and their address is 2810 Artesia Boulevard. 2810 Artesia Boulevard, Redonda, California, 90278. Parents Anonymous has to have a sponsor, and a church is one of the types of organizations that can sponsor them. And it would be just marvelous to put the Christian perspective on something like that. Another suggestion would be to plan a parenting program in which you could invite your membership, or you could branch out and invite the community, or work with the local mental health group to set up a parenting program. If you can't find a paid professional in your community who's capable of running a parenting program from a Christian perspective, and it's hard, I don't know if anybody's written a parenting program, educational materials that do use just a Christian approach, but I would suggest the book that is in the bookstore called Your Child's Self-Esteem by Dorothy Briggs as a way to start. If you even just started a book discussion group of that book, you would find it helpful. I think the reason I like that particular book is because it does build from Christian concepts. One of my students did a report on some chapters in it last year, and in her report she wrote, I think Dorothy Briggs must be a Christian, because the concepts from which she builds definitely are, you know, what we believe.
Name of that book.
Your Child's Self-Esteem. It's published by Doubleday, and it's really a gold mine. It's a bargain. It's only $2.95, and it's the way books are priced nowadays. I've been giving it as gifts for new babies and putting it on shelves for where parents get or have it available. Okay, I'll give you also some places that you could send for materials that you could use in a course like this, and then you could just, you know, add the Christian perspective in your group as you talk. One is the Minnesota Early Learning Design Curriculum Materials, MELD. And their address is 123 East Grant Street, Minneapolis, Minnesota, 55403. These are really neat materials. They are self-help materials. They are not published yet, so but by 1979 they will probably have them out. They're still field testing them. Another one would be one that whose publisher is a Holden Village person. In fact, his daughter's been on staff all summer and just went home. This is published by American Guidance Service. And the address is Publishers Building, Circle Pines, Minnesota, 55014. And the materials are called STEPS, Systematic Training for Effective Parenting, that you can just use STEPS. And I think that those two are planned on Christian concepts, so that if you just added your own scripture, you could make it into a very good one. All right, I'd also like to suggest that you form a group of retired persons who, or other volunteers as well, but I'm thinking of people, particularly housewives, whose children have left home and grown up, who feel like they have absolutely no job skills at all. Because one of my few quarrels with Women's Lib is that they tend to downplay housekeeping skills and homemaking skills, and I guess I feel like those are very, very important skills. And there are many people who have spent 30 and 40 years developing those skills and are very good at homemaking. And for those people to feel like they don't have anything to offer the world is just a real big waste in my way of thinking. And I remember when I was a young mother how much I would have liked to have somebody with those kinds of skills to come in and help me. In fact, I did have a lady in one of our churches who would come in at noon and she would stay with my baby and my toddler while I went off to graduate school, and she would still be there at midnight when I got home again. And, you know, I blessed that woman forever and ever. That was a fantastic gift to me. She didn't ask money for that. She just was doing it as a nice thing to do. But I think of another time when I got very sick and had to stay in bed, and the pastor could not stay home with his children because he had all these other sick people to call on. And we finally ended up paying someone to come in, and she really wasn't very good at it, and it wasn't very helpful. The toddler put herself to bed, and the baby, the woman just couldn't understand my New York way of putting a baby to bed for his nap outside in a baby carriage. They don't do that in Texas, and she couldn't figure this out. And when she went out to check on him and discovered there was a cat in the carriage, instead of removing the cat, she removed the baby and woke him up, and he was crying, and his sick mother had to get out of bed and take care of him. And, you know, there are people who know how to do that and can do it well, grandmotherly types, and I think it would be just really neat for a pastor to know that he had this group of women to call on and say, you know, Mrs. So-and-so is ill and really needs some homemaking skills, or here's a young mother who finds that she really doesn't know how to organize her day, and you do, you know, why don't you go work with her a little while and help her to develop those skills that you spent so long learning. Gosh, those are things that, why should we all have to rediscover the wheel and learn by trial and error? Some of these, well, I mean, I feel like I know those things now, and I wish I had known them when I was 23 and needed to know them. Another way to go with people in my age group and older would be to work with individual children who need more attention. There are many, many children who simply aren't achieving their potential in their public school life, not because they don't have the potential, but because they don't feel good enough about themselves to use what they've got. And that's because their parents don't have the resources to love them enough, or love them properly, I guess I should say. There are lots and lots of people in our congregations who do know how to give that love, who could go into a school spend time together with these children. And you can get into programs like that. If you have a teacher or a social worker in your congregation, you might work through them. I think sometimes pastors get wind of children who need some extra grandparenting. Our children have not had grandparents. My parents lived too far away, and the other grandparents died when the children were very young. Al Swihart has been a grandfather to my young boys when they were young here in the village. This is a marvelous thing for someone to do to a child who doesn't have access to that sort of thing. A model for this would be a Wise and Guys Volunteer Services. And you can write to them at Hall School, room 210. And that address is 1601 Aldrich Avenue North in Minneapolis, Minnesota, 55411. Wise and Guys is a program that helps school teachers. I think many of us that are in schoolrooms would just give our eye teeth for some lover of a elderly person to come in and sit with this child who needs more attention. They simply need more attention to blossom and bloom. And teachers don't have time to do that. Unfortunately, even with the glut on the teacher's market, we aren't providing the funds to provide more teachers for less kids, which is the neat way to go. So if there could be a volunteer who could help a child who's struggling with his math. Sometimes what he needs is not more comprehension of the math, but more attention. But sometimes it's the other two. So getting in through a school would for volunteers would be a neat way to go, too. Sometimes Lutheran Social Service could use extra volunteer help like this as well. Another neat way to go would be to help parents who are incarcerated. I talked to a prison chaplain of the women's division in the local prison where I live. And she was very, very concerned. She said, this is so hard on children when their parents are incarcerated. And here again, should children be punished for the mistakes their parents made? Or can we jump in and meet that need? She suggested that one really fantastic way to go would be to have a parenting program and take your group into the prison. You could work through the prison chaplain and take a parenting group to meet in the prison so that the prisoners who are parents would get to see that other people have these problems with their children too. It's not just because I'm so awful that I can't handle these things. And they would begin to think of things as being normal rather than way off the beaten path where they are. Another thing she suggested that they need very badly is when they are ready to leave prison, that they need support groups. And she suggested that three families in a congregation would say, we will be a support group, not a financial support group. If you were here last week, Walt Bowman told a horrible story where he tried to be a financial support to an ex-offender and got stuck for $2,000. And she suggested that was not helpful to loan the money or to make decisions for them, but to give them what we call moral support, to be active listeners, to take their children and them on outings with us, to give them some model for what normal family life can be. And another thing she suggested was that very often children can't come to see their parents in prison because they have no way to get there, and that this would be a good thing to do to transport children to see their parents so they're not so cut off all the time. Another biggie that I'd like to suggest for those of you that have organizational skills or can find somebody in your group that does is to organize a conference. And I can give you a model for that too that was just super. It was called Partners in Parenting, a Minnesota conference. And if you think this is heavy on Minnesota, it's because that's, you know, you tend to talk about what you know about. And I mostly know about Minnesota because that's where I spend most of my time. Partners in Parenting could send you their leftover materials if you wrote to them at 123 East Grant Street, Minneapolis. And that's 55403. And what Partners in Parenting did was to bring together parents and volunteers and professionals for a conference. And what they wanted to accomplish was to develop better communication, sharing ideas and learning techniques, to develop some coordination by identifying the needs to coordinate existing services, and to develop cooperation between all of us, and to give impetus to new working coalitions. One of the things they did was to have interest groups that came out of lecture sessions like this one and talked about what can we do with the information that we have now received? How can we carry this now back into the community so that it does advocate for children? And the group that I sat in on was going to go to major employers in the community and ask them to work on scheduling so that they built in flex time and daycare and shared jobs and some of these things that will be recommended in the book Call Our Children. Okay, quickly let's move then to congregational concerns. One of the things that one could do to advocate for children would be to have an expanded Sunday school program for the preschool set who are not in school on mornings. A congregation that I visited in California had tried this and found that it was just a fantastic way to go. They had Sunday school for preschoolers on Thursday morning. That wouldn't preclude having it also on Sunday morning, but on Sunday morning you usually end up with about 45 minutes actual relating time to the child by the time you take care of the roll calling and the opening exercises and all those sorts of things. And what these people did was to have 2.5 hours on Thursday, and the children came in play clothes instead of good clothes so they could actually do things. They could get down on the floor and get dirty, and they could do finger painting and clay work. And small children learn by doing. Any concepts that they internalize are not going to be internalized by the spoken word. It's going to be by what they do. They have to absorb it by actually experiencing it, not just by being told. So to have 2.5 hours for your preschool Sunday school would be just super. This could be a neat help for parents too. And when anytime you help parents, you're helping the child. If mother gets a time when she knows that she can schedule a doctor's or dental appointment or run her errands without a toddler along, she's maybe going to be a better mother all afternoon because she's had a break in the morning. So that's another good thing about it. Another thing the congregation could do would be to have a drop-in center for the young parents in the congregation and also for the community. This could include a daycare, a babysitting service, or it could include babysitting during a parent education time. It could include a library where you'd have good parent education materials, and you'd also have good books for children, good religious books as well as other literature. It could include a toy library where a child could come out, and perhaps you have somebody who's really knowledgeable about what kind of playthings children should have. There's an awful lot of junk on the market in the name of toys. Anything that you just watch and don't do with is not a worthwhile toy. Mostly toys with batteries are the kind that you just watch and don't get involved with. So somebody who knows what good toys are, good durable toys. Children sometimes tire of toys after a while. And they could be, the toy library could maybe be open once a month, and children could exchange toys. Another thing that I've never heard anybody doing, but a friend of mine thought this would be marvelous, because she said when they first got their white rat, everybody was fighting over who got to feed it. But in 3 months' time, it was who has to feed it that everyone was fighting over. And she thought it would be marvelous if someone started a pet library so children could have a variety of experiences with pets without getting tired of the responsibility of caring for it, that the responsibility would be a fresh one. That would have to be, I think, for a little older children, unless parents were really willing to do the work themselves.
Yeah. And it also have to be for a low-level pet, because you would just wipe a dog.
Oh, yeah, dogs
cat.
And cats
just
wouldn't like moving.
Wipe the dog out if you switched families every month.
I think it would have to be things like fish and gerbils and yeah. Guinea pigs who really don't get attached to people.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Pigs would never do, I'm sure.
What's wrong with teaching responsibility, or is that not something you have to worry about?
Oh, there's nothing wrong with it at all. But when it gets to be that you're being nagged to do it, then you're not accepting that responsibility. Then it gets to be a power struggle between parent and child. And the child isn't learning responsibility, he's learning how to avoid responsibility. That's another whole lecture. I think there's a tape on that if you want to hear it. Another thing that I can give you a model for is a program called Parents and Children Together, which I think would be a super way to go, where you would have the parents have a parenting session and the children having a fun nursery school experience, and then you would bring them together, because one of the things we really need to learn as parents is how to communicate with children when they're very young. Because if you don't develop and when they're very young, all of a sudden they're very old and you don't know, they're gone. You don't know how to talk to them. So that needs to be developed we need to learn how to play with our children. A model for that would be one that is held at Valley View School, Portland Avenue at 90th in Bloomington, Minnesota, 55420. And the woman to write there would be Mary Lou Spees, S-P-E-I-S. She's got a super program there where the parents and the children come together, and the parents get a good parenting skill session, and the children have a fun time with learning skills in another room, and then they come together and have another time together, which what they learn to do is, you know, how to carry this on at home. Another thing I think would be super in the congregation, and this is an idea that Barbara Knutson at our Department of Life and Mission supports very strongly, would be to develop parent support groups in a congregation. And these would be for parents of children who were baptized in a certain time sequence. And I think it could probably start with children from the week they were baptized until they were 6 months old. That could be one group. And then another group could be 6 months to a year, because children change very fast in those two groups. And then another group could be the 1 to 2 year olds, and another one 2 to 3 year olds, 3 to 5, 5 to 8, 8 to 12, and 13 to 15. You'd have, and maybe 15 to college would be another, or work, whichever they way they go. And I think groups like that could be supports to each other. It's neat to talk with other parents who are having the same developmental problems with their children, or at the same developmental level. I know how helpful it was to me to have a pediatrician who said things like, now you can expect that in the next month or two, the baby is going to lose interest in lunch. That's normal. I mean, I would have panicked if I hadn't known that, you know, babies tend to do this. I would have thought, well, he's ill. Why isn't he eating? And, you know, it's really very bad to try to force food on children, although I think as we seem to get the feeling that if I'm a good mother, you know, this child will eat. And actually it has nothing to do with how good a mother you are. It has to do with how hungry the child is. But we get that mixed up somehow, and that does a lot of damage to kids too. So, you know, just hearing about those kinds of things is helpful. And I think if we had groups like that that could meet maybe biannually or quarterly or something, with some professional person who has some expertise in child development, and then they could relate that to, you know, the life in baptism. What is the life in baptism for children? See, I never get done with this in an hour. Mm-hmm. I have three more things to tell you. Should I tell you real quick while the coffee gets cold? Okay, another one would be to begin neighborhood play groups of children in the congregation that live near together. If there would be a mother who would say, I will have these three children in my neighborhood, or maybe the mothers would like to take turns. There are not materials published for that, but I think if you used an alternative Sunday school packet, not the one that's being used Sundays, but somebody else's. I think most denominations have more than one offering in their catalog, that you could choose those and add a snack and add an art project and just have it be a fun time when children could get together to know each other on a very low scale thing, and that you could have some praying together and singing some religious songs, that would be a good way to go. The Norwegian Lutheran Church does that, and they have a very good program, but their materials are all in Norwegian, so unless you can read that, that's not too much help. I think another thing to do would be to offer this Homemakers Helpers group to young mothers that I mentioned before. And then I would think that a really good way to go would be to talk with the children in your congregation and have a group of children who would tell you how they felt they could be part of a congregational life. Could children be apprenticed to the ushers club? Could children be apprenticed to the altar committee? A church in our neighborhood, they're Presbyterian, but you, are there any Presbyterians here? I think we could take an idea from them if they don't know we're stealing. They have families being the greeters on Sunday morning and families taking up the offering. I mean, a five-year-old, look at the five-year-olds that are helping and the six-year-olds in the dining hall right now. You know, there is absolutely no reason why they can't shift the offering basket back and forth. Is there any reason why you have to be a man aged 48 or older in order to pass an offering basket? There are many ways that children could be included in the life of the congregation. And if you really want to get way out, maybe you can do some of the things that some of our younger congregations are doing where, you know, why put the pencils in the pew racks? Maybe that's something that the three-year-olds could do. That's a cognitive task three-year-olds need to learn, is one-to-one correspondence. You know, can you give every person a pencil? Okay, a lot of creative thinking is needed on that, and that can be done back home in your congregation. Thank you.
Thank you.